My name is Lisa Arkin, and I'm here with Mary O'Brien. We're here to talk about the city of Eugene and its place in history in terms of the Toxics Right to Know movement and toxics use reduction actions and policies. I'm director of Beyond Toxics, a nonprofit based here in Eugene, but who works statewide. And I'm thrilled to be speaking with Mary because she's the founder of Beyond Toxics and has a rich and deep history in the environmental protection movement. So I think we should really begin by asking Mary about how she got started here in the little city of Eugene with taking on the role of toxics in the environment and some of the policies that became viable here in Eugene that are models for other cities, states, and really the whole country.
Well, it was actually 30 years ago. I had just finished a doctorate in botany down in California, and I came to work for Northwest Coalition for Alternatives to Pesticides because, of course, we were working with forestry issues, and it happened to be the years of aerial herbicide spraying with 2,4-5-T, and then when it was suspended by the EPA, 2,4-D.
I just want to ask, was that at the same time as the Vietnam War? Did it have anything to do with?
We were spraying after the Vietnam War, after it was no longer, the Army was no longer using 2,4-5-T and 2,4-D in war, but we were still using it aerially in western Lane County and in western Oregon on the forestry.
And why did they use, just as an aside, why did they use chemicals like that in war, and why were they using them in Oregon?
They were using it for defoliation to expose humans who were our considered enemies, to take the leaves off of trees, and they were being used here in western Oregon after a clear cutting of conifers to kill any broadleaf trees that might come in and sprout up and so-called compete with the new planted conifer, Douglas fir. Now, eventually they learned this is kind of crazy because, for instance, one of the broadleaf trees is red alder, which fixes nitrogen, which makes it more possible for the conifers to grow. But at the time, it was, we'll kill everything in the way of our little conifer seedlings. So I became involved in this issue of aerial spraying. And it ended up with a series of court cases, which started with one court case with a lawyer here in Eugene. And it was the first time a judge here in Oregon had ruled that the Forest Service was not admitting, actually, this may have been a BLM case initially. No, it was a Forest Service one first. Was not admitting that 2,4-D could cause cancer. And yet in the federal rules of environmental impact statements, you needed at the time to state what could go wrong with your project, whether any project that the federal agency was mm-hmm. doing. And they wouldn't admit that 2,4-D was associated with cancers, some cancers. So they kept losing in the court. And eventually, there was a series of actually five court cases. And finally, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said that the Forest Service in Oregon and Washington, Region 6, and Oregon in BLM, could not spray one drop of herbicide until they redid an environmental impact statement that was accurate. So at that point, NCAP was working primarily with the Forest Service and said, let's work together, and one of the alternatives in the new environmental impact statement will be a least use herbicide alternative. That is, doesn't say no herbicides can be used, but try other things first.
Mm-hmm.
Show why you would need herbicide and other methods like planting older conifer seedlings wouldn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And so they agreed to do that because you don't have to choose the best alternative. We just wanted them to include that alternative. Mm-hmm. Well, it turned out they thought that was the best alternative too. And that's what the Forest Service adopted for Oregon and Washington. And ever since then, they have no longer done that kind of aerial spraying that they once did.
Mm-hmm. I just have to ask if that work led to your highly respected book, Alternative Risk Assessment. Is that how you got started on offering
Yes,
that?
Alternatives to Risk Assessment, because instead of asking the question that risk assessment asks, which is, how much can we spray and it's okay? Not too many cancers will happen. Not too much birth defects will happen.
Or an acceptable rate.
Right, an acceptable rate.
If there's ever such a thing.
Instead, ask, what's the least amount of an environmentally risky behavior, like spraying herbicides or using pesticides in food? What's the least we need to do? What are the alternatives? So that did turn that around. And then it's a little hard to remember getting to you and beyond toxics. Hyundai was coming to Eugene,
mm-hmm.
and people were alarmed for a number of reasons. It was an industrial complex out in a rural area.
In a wetland.
It was building in mm-hmm. a wetland. And it was going to be releasing toxic chemicals, and we didn't know really what ones they were. So we went to the city council and said, would you require Hyundai to tell what chemicals they would be using? They said no. So we basically went to the streets, got 11,000 signatures on a toxics right to know reporting law that would require not only Hyundai, but all of the industries that were using toxics within the Eugene city boundaries mm-hmm. to report all of the toxics they took in and which ones left. Kind of like just money accounting, how much money comes into your business and how much money goes out. And
that's called mass balancing. Right.
Because
it balances what they start with at the beginning of the year and accounts for where everything is gone up to the end.
Yeah, and is it going into the air? How much is going into barrels that are carried off the site? How much is going into sewers? Where is it going? And it turned out to be, you know, these industries are very technically competent. Turned out they could do it, and they have been reporting ever since. And I think you came in at that time
mm-hmm.
when we were gathering signatures for the Toxics Right to Know law, right?
Yeah, that was in, well, the law passed in 1996, and that's actually when I started to get involved. So
and that was with Citizens for Public Accountability.
Right.
And Citizens for Public Accountability was formed because the introduction of this industrial facility had been done without public input.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't going to be public accountability for the toxics. There wasn't going to be a public accountability for what if they left in 3 years.
And the funding was using
public
money that would have gone to schools.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea was there ought to be public accountability for activities that put the community at risk traffic-wise, economic-wise, toxics-wise, whatever. There ought to be public accountability.
And, you know, the law you were referring to or the ordinance that you passed with all those signatures, which...
Well, it wasn't an ordinance. It was a constitutional amendment because if we had just passed it as an ordinance,
mm-hmm.
the next city council could have reversed it.
True, true. So a constitutional amendment to that. Charter, the
right.
city charter. What's interesting, one of the many interesting things about that, and there's a lot we can talk about, is that it's very much a human rights doctrine because even though the regulatory agencies like the Department of Environmental Quality or the Lane Regional Air Protection Agency has records about what is being emitted from all of these industries, these records are not the kind of thing that your average person could get access to or even understand. They're highly technical. So by creating this publicly accessible database of what's going into the air, what's going into the water, what's going into the product, you opened up, your vision, Mary, was to open up that information for all the public to have.
Right, and soon after we passed this law, the state legislature, and I must say it was with the enabling by then Governor Kitzhaber, they passed a law that said no other community could pass a law like this.
That's right, they really clamped down on it.
And I thought, you know, we succeeded in Eugene because clearly people believe they should have the right to know about what toxics are in their community. And because we weren't a statewide organization, other communities can't have that same right. And that's when the idea came to me of forming what was originally called Oregon Toxics Alliance.
Mm-hmm. And that you started on that around the year 1999, year 2000.
Right. And by then, I was not so active directly in toxics. I was working for Hell's Canyon Preservation Council on Eastern Oregon side on conservation issues in Hell's Canyon National Recreation Area. But here was this active, vibrant woman, Lisa Arkin, in Citizens for Public Accountability, who had recently left teaching at the University of Oregon as a dance professor, and I thought, I think she could be a good director for this.
Well, I certainly learned the passion from you, and being a member of Citizens for Public Accountability was a great training ground. It was a vibrant, smart group of people, and we really took issues on, you know, by the horn, as they say, and did it in a very scientific way, you know, led by you. And we did a lot of other projects that mixed public accountability, toxics, and environmental protection. I remember when you and I really went to bat to stop gravel mining on prime farmland in the Willamette Valley. And we stopped a series of massive gravel pits that they were going to just tear up Class 1 soil. And we also worked together to make sure that Hyundai didn't expand their factory. They would have doubled
because
in size and then left the community.
And then left. And we knew how volatile that industry is and
mm-hmm.
how it can pick up and leave a community in the middle of the night, essentially. And so it's a fortunate thing that more of our wetlands in West Eugene
were not destroyed.
Right.
Only to be abandoned later with empty buildings on them. And here it is, the year 2013, and those buildings are still sitting empty on the wetlands.
And it's also an interesting little twist. There were certain rules about their building, and one of the things they needed to do was keep sediment out of the water that then flows through
Amazon Creek,
right.
Willow Creek into Amazon Creek, into the Willamette watershed.
And citizens found that in fact they weren't following the rules of keeping sediment out. We did settle with them.
With a lawsuit,
and with the money that we were awarded, we bought some headwaters of Amazon Creek
mm-hmm.
for the public.
And funded water quality testing programs at Churchill High School and some of the elementary schools to teach kids about science and water quality. That was great.
So yeah. it's a great history of citizens demanding accountability for toxics and other impacts that take place in the city.
Mm-hmm. And that today we get phone calls and emails from various other places around the country because the city of Eugene still has the model program. And as far as I'm aware, it's still the only toxics reporting program that is mass balance based, which provides a much more accurate, or provides inaccurate accounting of really where all these toxins are going. Federal programs such as the EPA Toxics Release Inventory are still based on self-reporting that the industry basically...
And it doesn't have to be mass balanced.
No, they don't have to account really for how they came up with their numbers.
And and there's a very high threshold of toxics use before you start reporting. Ours is down
2,000 pounds. Right?
Right.
Yeah, 2,000 pounds. So when Beyond Toxics recently did the first ever toxics tour of in Oregon, but we held it out in West Eugene, we compared how the federal government reports data on the toxics release inventory with the City of Eugene Toxics Right to Know, and we found that the information provided at the city level is far more detailed and exacting and useful to citizens. And it's playing a big role in how we are looking at childhood asthma in West Eugene and correlating emissions from industrial sites with cases of childhood asthma. So,
and that's ironic given that Governor Kitzhaber, who's a physician, allowed, it's you know, a behind the scenes story, but he allowed and did not veto a law passing the legislature that said communities other than Eugene could not learn the exact amounts of chemicals and which industries were releasing it,
mm-hmm.
and into what medium, air, water, trucking it off site, whatever.
And of course, the industry's excuse that would cause them to go bankrupt has been proven false, because no industry, business, or commercial endeavor in Eugene has closed down because of the Toxics Right to Know law. And actually, probably the fire marshal who collects that information finds it immeasurably helpful to safety, public safety, knowing which flammable chemicals are on site and in what amounts they are on site. So all that data is collected by the Eugene Fire Marshal.
So now, to come to a little less sanguine place, it's strange that 30 years ago we were working to end aerial spraying of 2,4-D on Forest Service lands for forestry, and now Beyond Toxics is in the middle of exposing how much aerial spraying of 2,4-D is going on near Triangle Lake, just 10, 15 miles west of Eugene on private forestry lands.
That's right. Unfortunately, when the federal government, through the Bureau of Land Management and the Forest Service, was doing the right thing and reducing or stopping their use of aerial application of these pesticides, the private industry went to work here in Oregon to change laws to make it very difficult not only to stop the practice, but to learn what they were spraying, where, how much, when. So it's only because recently so many Oregon rural residents were complaining again, just like when you started, Mary, complaining of health impacts, whether it be miscarriages or cancers or extreme chemical sensitivities and rashes, headaches, bloody noses, whatever the ailment, complaints were coming in, and which eventually led citizens to really demand some accountability. Oh, it's a convoluted story, but because of some urine testing, which found 2,4-D and atrazine in 100% of the 39 people who were tested, and this included kids as young as 6 and 7 and all the way up to people in their 70s, because it was found in urine long after any spray had occurred, which means it was either remaining in their body, not being metabolized out, or it was somehow remaining in the environment, and they were getting continual chronic exposures. We don't know yet. But because of that, the EPA working with our state agencies, the Oregon Health Authority, began an investigation called the Triangle Lake Investigation to look into what was really happening with aerial pesticide and ground pesticide sprays in the forest land in West Lane County. And for the first time ever since these laws were enacted to shield forest companies from having to supply their pesticide application data, we were Beyond Toxics was able, with the help of residents out there in Triangle Lake, get the private spray records from the from our state agencies, which had demanded that the applicators turn it over. And we've been mapping it and looking for patterns with what's being sprayed, how much is being sprayed, and where it's being sprayed. So this kind of data collection hasn't happened since the example you gave way back when the federal government started to take a look
right,
at it.
Right, and one high school English teacher in Alsea had learned that 2,4-5-T, which was still being sprayed,
which is part of Agent Orange,
the other half being 2,4-D,
can
cause miscarriages. And two or three of her past students had dropped by, talked with her, they liked her a lot, and mentioned they'd had miscarriages. So she walked door to door throughout the entire community of Alsea, found that 8 people had had miscarriages, and the great bulk of them had had those very soon after aerial spraying of 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T. So that was a citizen mapping by going to every house in the community of Alsea. And eventually the EPA came out, confirmed that those miscarriages had happened in association, close time association with aerial spraying. And then the Lincoln County Health Department had demanded they come back and do more in-depth, and they compared Alsea miscarriages in Lincoln County with, I believe, up in Portland, which is an industrial county, and an eastern Oregon rural county that didn't have aerial spraying because it didn't have forests, and found that only in Lincoln County did you have this bump in the spring of miscarriages. And at that point, they suspended on an emergency basis 2,4-5-T. Now 2,4-D, which is not as potent at producing miscarriages, but has its own problems. Nerve problems in your hands and feet, cancers, is now still being sprayed. So it always is the case, just as President Obama said in his inaugural address today, citizens have to be active.
That's right.
And that's the history of toxics in Eugene, whether it's the aerial spraying of herbicides for forestry, whether it's the release of toxics by Hyundai, whether it's whether pesticides are used in public schools and parks and post offices. Eugene got quite early. I wish I could remember what year the integrated pest management for the schools in Eugene, which was an early activity.
Right.
And it's kind of interesting because I actually live in Utah now most of the time. I work for Grand Canyon Trust on Forest Service issues there in Utah. But I just came in through the airport a couple of days ago because I'm here for a conference actually on beavers.
Eugene Airport.
And it has a overhead screen, and it's talking about Eugene being a green city, number 5 in, I don't know, some survey. And you think, yes, in lots of ways, and no, in lots of ways, and that it always takes citizen action. because we shouldn't be dealing with aerial spraying of 2,4-D 30 years after that was recognized as something that wasn't wise for the Forest Service to do, and they don't do it.
Right, and now it's just in private forestry and in our state forests as well. And we're working, Beyond Toxics is continuing to work by helping to pass the state law to pretty much ban pesticide use in schools. And it's not exactly a ban, but it's working on the principle you were discussing, the least toxic alternative, so that that law went into effect in July of 2012, which is the strongest law in the nation, I do believe, to protect school children, teachers, and other personnel on school campuses from unnecessary uses of pesticides. And school districts have been thrilled by how that law has turned out and what help has come to them to learn how to manage pests without having to rely on these neurotoxins.
And you certainly don't hear the Forest Service complaining that they can't grow trees.
Absolutely not.
And without the herbicides, which they once claimed.
Mm-hmm.
But it was interesting. When the lawsuits came down and finally the Forest Service called Northwest Coalition for Alternatives to Pesticides, the regional office up in Portland, Region 6. And they said, what do we have to do to not see you in court anymore?
Mm-hmm.
And we said three things. One, don't go to Oregon State University for your toxicology because they keep saying that 2,4-D is safe and you keep losing in the courts as a result. Second, let's write an alternative that says least use of herbicides. You don't have to choose that alternative. You just have to write it and include it. And thirdly, why don't you come down for a day to the Northwest Coalition for Alternatives to Pesticides office, which was in Growers Market down by the train station. And we'll give you some ideas on alternatives to use of herbicides. Now, I think they thought, well, we'll come down and listen to Northwest Coalition for Alternatives to Pesticides staff people tell us what we ought to do in our forests. But unbeknownst to them, we knew various district rangers who were already using methods that didn't require herbicides, different silviculturists, different district ranger districts. They didn't want to fight the local people about herbicides, and they had been quietly using other methods. So when Region 6 staff came down from Portland to Growers Market, all of the speakers were their own people saying, we've already got alternatives. We don't have to be doing this. And that's the interesting thing about toxics. There are always alternatives. I remember during the years I was here in Eugene, I served 5 years on a United Nations committee on methyl bromide, which is a fumigant in the soil that when it's released, like if you've seen plastics over strawberry fields in mm-hmm. California, that used to be methyl bromide being fumigated into the soil. When the plastics lift, it goes up to the ozone and destroys the ozone layer. Well, this committee went around the world talking about learning from different countries what their alternatives were. And our report at the end of the 5 years that we studied all over the world was that already alternatives existed for 90% of the use methyl bromide.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't need to use it. And that's nearly always the case.
And now I think what's changed since 30 years ago is that there's, first of all, a lot more scientific data on the harmful impacts of these chemicals, both to the environment and to human health. I think everyone is pretty aware that these chemicals pass from the mother onto the fetus and can cause quite a bit of damage as the fetus is developing, neurological damage, resulting in permanent cognitive impairment. That's sort of, we accept that data now, whereas I think 30 years ago, we were still having to prove.
Well, and 30 years ago, you couldn't find the organic food right. availability that's mm-hmm. in Eugene now, with how many stores in Eugene, everything from the original ones like Kiva and Sundance on up to Market of Choice.
Capella.
There's just a much greater sense in Eugene that these chemicals can be toxic.
But even to the point where if you go on the EPA website, in terms of children's health and toxics, they themselves will say the best thing you can do is buy organic food for your children, because one of the primary pathways a kid is exposed to pesticides is through the food that they eat.
And never mind that when you're growing food organically, the children of the farm workers aren't living right next mm-hmm. to a field where the spray is going on. So it's interesting, and at one level, how far we've come, and then very clear that Beyond Toxics as an organization is still so much needed, and is such an outlet for citizens who want to take control of their lives and help make their community healthier. How many interns are you working with right now? You're working with a whole class
University of Oregon. Yep, 30 students from the University of Oregon, plus about 6 or 7 interns, and volunteer hours from well-educated and experienced people who have recently retired from some of the agencies we just talked about, whether it was Fish and Wildlife or Forest Service or DEQ, people who've worked all their lives in the environmental arena and have found Beyond Toxics as an outlet to use their skills for the further protection of the environment. So that's been quite a boon for us in enabling us to do these massive mapping projects. And because of the foresight of people like you and our current board members, we're really linking human rights with environmental protection and toxics reduction. So much of our work is unique in that we're continually tying together the human right to know what's in your air, what's in your water, to be able to have a say-so about what's in your air and water and what you consume through food or your personal products, and to change policy.
Well, and I think it's always poignant to realize that the fish can't take control of their own lives that way. They can't protect their own community mm-hmm. unless folks like your volunteer, who's a retired fish biologist from Forest Service, she's helping to stand up for the salmon that are in mm-hmm. the Triangle Lake creeks, because the other species can't speak for themselves. Only citizens can.
You're so right. And even though that study came about because of human health impacts, in the course of mapping all these pesticides, we're finding that there are tremendous impacts into these very rare anadromous salmon habitat streams. These are, when I say rare, there's not every place in the world that there's cold water that's just right for mating patterns of the salmon, where they can hatch their juvenile salmon and those salmon can then find their way back to the ocean. I mean, Oregon is blessed in that way. And you're right, those salmon can't speak up for themselves. So it's our studies and how we're analyzing the data that will eventually help us show that these practices of using helicopters to distribute pesticides over tens of thousands of acres doesn't make any sense, and it's certainly not necessary to have a viable forestry industry. I also wanted to kind of circle back to all the work that you, Mary, did to help Eugene pass the charter amendment for citizens' right to know, or toxics' right to know. And
well, it was a great experience gathering the 11,000 signatures, because you'd go walk up to someone and say, I've got a Would you put your signature on putting on the ballot a law that would say you get to know what chemicals are being released by industry in the community? And it was so interesting because it took a lot of hours being out on the street by a lot of people, but it wasn't that hard because, of course, people, they would often say, "You mean I don't already have that right?" And I remember one time, this guy was walking up the street and he had on black leather motorcycle pants and a black jacket. He's a kind of a big guy and he's kind of swaggering up the street. And I said, "Hi, would you like to put your signature on this petition to get this on the ballot to know about the toxics that are being released by the industries in the town?" He says, "Yeah, I'll sign that." He says, "I'll sign for my sister too." You know, you can't. You can only sign for yourself. He says, "I know she'd sign it too." I said, "Sorry." So it's kind of 200% that people believe they ought to have the right to know about toxics, and they're so interested to learn that about alternatives that toxics don't have to be used in the first place.
You know, I have to bring up another win that showed about alternatives because it was so important to the city of Eugene and the Willamette Valley, and that was the ban on field burning in the Willamette Valley, where the farmers were insisting that there was no alternative other than burning the field, and we were able to show, Beyond Toxics was able to show, not only were there great alternatives, they'd make them more money. They could rotate crops and have crops growing all year round, such as meadow foam, which is used in the cosmetic industry. So it's been a win-win. But the main thing is we were able to show the relationship between the air pollution caused by burning fields and the increase in acute asthma attacks. Again, bringing it back around to community right to know what's being done, the looking for alternatives, and then showing how human health would be improved and air pollution and global warming and, you know, not ruining our ozone layer. So
that's always the case.
Mm-hmm.
So few toxics really need to be used.
So I think Eugene is really at the center of a lot of the best work in our nation about reducing toxics and making sure that our health and in terms of the future generations and the health of those who can't speak for themselves, such as the fish or the birds or the beavers, that it's all part of one ecosystem.
And really, it'll always be important to elect city council members and mayors who believe in the ingenuity of humans to come up with alternatives. Alternative transportation, alternatives to toxics, alternative ways of alternative schools. This is a community that fundamentally recognizes that there are always better alternatives.